Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Preachers Forum podcast. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, coming to you once again from The Rock, where I live in North Wales with my wife, Lisa. And I'm a transplanted American living here in the United Kingdom. We've been here almost 12 years now. It's amazing to think how much has changed in those 12 years since we left the United States to come over here. I came to pursue doctoral studies at the University of Chester. We had walked away from a very painful experience as pastors of a church in the Portland, Oregon area. And I swore up and down that I never wanted to have anything to do with the church or Christians again. And even though I am still critical of the church in many ways, a lot has changed in those 12 years. And I feel like God has done an amazing work of healing and restoration in both my life and my wife Lisa's as well. But as you'll hear in my conversation in this episode with Steve Austin from Birmingham, Alabama, in the United States, people like him have restored my faith in both Christians and the church, or at least perhaps what the church could be or should perhaps be. So I'm really excited to bring you this conversation, which is part of my series I'm in the middle of doing. I call it Mind Shift. And I'm helping people to think critically about God, the church, and spirituality, which is, of course, the aim of the Preachers Forum podcast and website. So in this episode, we want to perhaps think differently about this issue of mental health, bad theology, and the church. I met Steve Austin through some mutual friends, the Holy Heretics, John and Scott. We both support them on Patreon, and we met up on Facebook several months ago, and we've kind of become Facebook friends in a way, and it's been a great kind of experience to get to know Steve a little bit more, and I'm super excited that he agreed to take some time out of his busy schedule to have this conversation with me, which you'll hear in a minute. It's an absolutely great conversation. It's all about bad theology, mental health, and the church. Is that a toxic mix? Because for sure, in the church, in many churches at least, the subject of mental health is a very murky one. It's a difficult one to deal with, especially if you're in church leadership. It strikes me that there's kind of a couple of elements to this issue, isn't there? I mean, on the one hand, you have people who may have existing mental health issues that then seek to join a church. Maybe they become a Christian and they join a church. And so in a sense, they're kind of bringing those pre-existing conditions into the church. The other possibility, of course, is that someone may be a member of a church and something might happen to that person and they begin to experience mental health issues such as depression or some other mental health issue. Are churches really equipped and able to deal with people that have mental health, mental illnesses, and mental problems? A lot of times, unfortunately, the answer is no. I know for sure when I was an elder, when I was a pastor, we didn't know how to handle situations that arose from time to time, dealing with things like depression, schizophrenia, people with bipolar disorder, just to name a few mental health issues and problems that people have. And we had no resources. In fact, when I first became an elder, we were actually part of a counseling network, and several churches were supposed to be chipping in to pay for this network. But unfortunately, the people in our church and the other churches really didn't see it as a priority. So eventually, the funding dried up for this counseling center, and they had to close, which was a real shame. So it may well be that there may be, in fact, a lack of support or even knowledge of this issue within some churches. And then there's another aspect, I think, to this issue of mental health, and that is among church leaders, pastors, youth workers, children's ministry workers, whatever position you might be in. We find that due to the expectations, due to the stresses of leadership, it's all too common for pastors and church leaders to develop some serious mental health issues and certainly burn out, suffer from depression, and other issues, and you feel perhaps like you can't talk to anybody about it because you're the one that's supposed to be in charge. You're supposed to be the expert. You're supposed to be the shining example of what a victorious Christian looks like. And so you cannot admit that you struggle with things like pornography and depression and doubts about your faith or perhaps mental health issues. And so this is why I think a conversation like the one I had with Steve Austin is so important, because as Steve said, he said, hey, I'm an open book. And so what you'll hear in this interview in just a minute is Steve being open, honest, and brutally frank about his struggles, his issues that he is in some ways still working through, as are we all. And so I don't want to spend too much time talking about it. I want to get right to the conversation with Steve Austin. I'll just say really quickly before we begin that I'll talk a little bit more about how you can get a hold of both myself and Steve Austin at the end of the show on social media and websites and so forth. So let's get right into the conversation that I had with Steve Austin on this episode of Mind Shift right here on the Preacher's Forum podcast. I call this episode Bad Theology, Mental Health, and the Church, a Toxic Mix. Let's find out with Steve Austin. All right, I am here with Steve Austin. Are you the $6 million man? Because I'm sure you've never heard that before.
No, never. That or the Stone Cold guy.
Yeah, I'm sure you never have. I mean, I'll tell you what, when I was a kid, I actually had a Steve Austin doll, a $6 million man action figure. No, it's not a doll. It's an action figure.
Funny. Right, if a boy's playing with it, it's an action figure. That's right.
Yeah, it's not a doll. It's an action figure. Yeah, so I saw your name, and we've kind of, I guess, we've become Facebook friends in a way, haven't we? I don't know you personally,
but we've
both supported the Holy Heretics on Patreon, and we've met up on the Holy Heretics Facebook group, and I really enjoy the stuff that you write about. I can see you're very passionate about mental health. I mean, why are you so passionate about mental health? And as it relates to theology in the church, would you say that's kind of your wheelhouse?
Yeah, it is. I'm passionate about it because I'm a former pastor who nearly died by suicide. So
it is
my story, yeah.
You've written a book about it called From Pastor to Psych Ward.
Can you
tell us your story? I mean, how does a pastor end up basically on the verge of committing suicide? What were the factors that led you to that kind of place?
Yeah, we have to start way back. So when I was just a preschooler, not quite 4 years old, I was a victim of childhood sexual abuse.
Wow.
And growing up in small town Alabama, buckle of the Bible Belt, very rural area where everybody knew everybody, and gossip was sort of the news of the day, you know.
Right.
I think my very young parents at the time were scared and didn't know what to do, and so they wrongly assumed that, oh, he's this little bitty boy, he'll never remember this, let's move on. And that was not the case, unfortunately. This happened, thankfully, only once. It was the neighbor's son. He was about 17, and I was almost 4. And my mom was tutoring this kid after school. So very comfortable around our home, very comfortable around me. And she threatened the kid, I think, within an inch of his life and just said, don't ever step foot on our property again. She knew that his dad was a raging alcoholic and was fearful that if this was reported that it would be worse on him, and again, just assumed, I'm just this little boy, I'll never remember. She was very, very young. And it's unfortunate, it happens a lot that parents don't have the right information, they don't have the right resources, they don't know what to do. And so in my parents' case, they made a bad decision. I love my parents, so, you know, we have moved on, and there's healing there, thank goodness. But it was a very, very unfortunate event and a tragedy and a trauma that the event physically happened once, but I have relived it in my mind and in flashbacks and PTSD for the last 30 years. So, well, I say the last 30 years, that is not accurate. I have relived it since I was a senior in high school. I had my my first flashback when I was a senior in high school. I was a leader in my school, very involved, Mr. Straight A, involved in everything you could be involved in, guy who seemed to be on top of the world. And we were, I was a part of this leadership cohort where they would pick two or three students from each school in the district, and we would take field trips once a month or so to government agencies, businesses, and we would meet leaders in our community and hear their story and ask them questions, and just a really cool thing. But this particular day, we were at the Department of Human Resources, which might be Child Protective Services or something like that in other places. But anyway, we're at the Department of Human Resources, and the director of all the social workers was in the room with us, and it was this, I remember it being a stark white, cold block wall conference room. We're sitting around this table, and I kept thinking, how could any child be comfortable in here? And she's telling what the social workers do and the different services they provide, and she brought out this doll, and not an action figure. She brought out this doll, and she said, you know, this is the type of doll that we would use when a kid has been abused. If a child has been physically abused or molested, and the child would point to wherever on the doll and say, this is what happened to me. And all of a sudden, all these memories that had been suppressed for, gosh, 15 years started flooding back. And that's the thing about anxiety, PTSD, flashbacks, things like that. They don't care where you are or who you're with or what you're doing. They are equal opportunity tormentors. And so all this stuff comes flooding back, and I can't call it a flashback at the time because I don't have that language, but sweaty palms, knot in the back of my throat, in the pit of my stomach, racing heart, and all I knew is, I've got to get out of this room. I'm there with my peers. I'm there with teachers and chaperones, and I'm the guy who has it all together and has this thing figured out and is going places, you know. And I just, man, I was falling apart quick. And so I rushed out of the room, tried to be as inconspicuous as I could, and a teacher followed me out, and I just collapsed against the wall and sank down on the floor and tried to describe what was going on. I thought I was having a heart attack. I thought I was dying. I thought, this is it. I'm here. I am 18 years old. I'm out of here. And, you know, I kind of laugh at it now because it sounds ridiculous, but at the time it's scary as hell. And so I explained what was going on, and the teacher said, Steve, it sounds like you're having a panic attack. So I, long story short, made it home and started telling my mom the stuff that had happened and these memories that I was having and all this stuff that was going on. And my mom and I were very close. I was I was a good old mama's boy, and she was my best friend growing up. She was my, you know, my cheerleader, always in my corner. I could talk to mom about anything. And I remember it being the first time that my mom didn't make eye contact with me, and the shame around it, how awkward, how uncomfortable, the humiliation, the regret, all of those things that she was going through as I'm telling these things. Because remember, 15 years before this, this is the three-year-old who's never going to remember. And so, strong Christian family, evangelical home, ultra-conservative, she prayed for me. And then we never talked about it again. That was it. And there was no counseling. There was no therapy. There was no, hey, maybe we should get you to talk to somebody. It was what my friend J.J. Landis says. She wrote a book called Some Things You Keep about life after her mother's suicide. And she says, you can't just take a magic Jesus pill and suddenly everything's okay. And that's sort of my goal today, is to help churches and church people realize that sometimes we need more than just a magic Jesus pill. That your faith is great, it's important. If that is your thing, then cling to it. But we are a whole person, mind, body, and spirit. And so sometimes we need counseling. Sometimes we need to go to the hospital. Sometimes we need medication for a while. We need a support group. We need self-care. You know, we need all of these things to support our whole person. And I didn't get that. So we swept it under the rug, graduated high school, went to college, went to Bible college for a couple of years, became a youth pastor and a worship leader, and served in ministry for about a decade. And all during this time, I'm having more flashbacks. The black dog of depression is nipping at my heels. I had gone finally to, after having a panic attack at work, I was working at a 911 center as a dispatcher, and had a terrible panic attack in the middle of work. And my boss said, you've got to go to the doctor and get help, or you can't come back. And that was the tough love I needed. It was the push I needed to get help. And so I went to my primary care physician and, you know, explained what was going on, and she put me on an antidepressant and anti-anxiety, and wow, it was sort of like putting on glasses for the first time. You walk out and go, there's leaves on that tree. I can see a little more clearly now. It's a huge help. And so that helped, but I was still scared to death to let anybody know that I was taking meds, because where I grew up, you can't be Christian and crazy. You can be one or the other.
Yeah, I was going to say, a lot of Christians,
I would hide in the stall. Just say it again.
Yeah, I was going to say, a lot of Christians have issues with taking medication, don't they? You know, that you shouldn't take medication.
Yeah, there's a terrible stigma.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, you got pastors on high cholesterol meds, and you got people on meds for their arthritis and chronic pain and this and that and the other, but yeah, you shouldn't take something for your brain.
No, heaven forbid.
Yeah, heaven forbid.
Ironic,
it's something. So the stigma is just debilitating at times, especially in the church world. So I was in ministry for about 10 years, and September of 2012, it's been almost 5 years, September of 2012, I had lost my job, and there were some really terrible accusations made about me as a school board employee. I was working as an interpreter. I'm a sign language interpreter. And I was working as a school board, as an interpreter in the school system, and then doing this youth pastor thing on Sundays and Wednesdays. And some terrible accusations were made, and I was let go from my job. This full investigation, you know, here's this young male school board employee, church employee, and accusations of a really inappropriate nature were made. And I just thought, you know, nobody's going to believe me. Nobody's going to believe my story. My wife's going to leave me. I've already got terrible mental illness. Nobody knew that I was addicted to pornography for 20 years. And I thought, if they take this thing to the extreme and start searching in, you know, my internet history and all this stuff, I'm going to be labeled as a freak, as a child molester. And that's what I had, you know, I knew what that was like, and heaven forbid somebody think that about me. And about 6 months before this happened, my fourth grade teacher was arrested and charged and put in jail for molesting little girls in his fourth grade class for years and years and years. And I just thought, man, this is what people think of me. And so I was working an out-of-town contract job as an interpreter, and stayed in a hotel room for 2 weeks. And what Brene Brown describes as a shame spiral just happened, and it was this shame storm. I was caught up in, this is never going to get better. This is only going to get worse. You are all alone. No one's ever going to trust you. No one's ever going to believe you. You are a failure. You're crazy. and, you know, you got all this stuff going on. When, even if they are able to do this investigation and prove that you're innocent, your wife's going to find out that you've been addicted to pornography for 20 years. She's going to leave you. You got a one-year-old little boy who needs a good daddy. The best thing that you could do would be to end it all and let them start over. She's young. She's beautiful. She's got her whole life ahead of her. This little boy's never going to remember you. Just get out of here and let them start over.
Wow. So, and, yeah, you're doing them a favor.
That's what I tried to do.
Yeah. You're doing them a favor by ending it in that rationalization.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable the amount of rationalization and just the lies that we tell ourselves. But when you're in that place, that's a very dark place, isn't it? It's incredibly dark.
It's the scariest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I tell people all the time, especially when you're depressed, the worst thing you can do is be alone. And here I am, 2 hours from home in a hotel room. I don't have contact with anybody for 2 weeks in the deepest, darkest place of my life.
Yeah.
I have nobody to talk to. I have no support system. I feel like I can't tell my wife what's really going on inside because there's all this external stuff going on out here. I don't want to add to it. And so, yeah, people talk about how suicide is so irrational, and they're right, but it doesn't feel that way in the heat of the moment. When you think, I have no other option, it feels very rational. So I mixed up tens of thousands of milligrams of prescription meds and over-the-counter drugs and swallowed them back and tried to end it all. And, you know, I tell people, you know, you hear about people who try to kill themselves, that it's a cry for attention, it's a cry for help. That was not it for me. I fully intended to die. I read up, I did my research, I did the work, I was out of here. And woke up almost 24 hours later, about 20 hours later, in ICU. It was the last day of my contract job, and when I didn't show up, my clients couldn't figure out what was going on, and they made several phone calls and got in touch with my wife, who hadn't heard from me, but she knew that I had been in a funk with all of this that was going on, and so they broke in the hotel room and thankfully got me out of there. I don't remember any of that, but I woke up in ICU mad as hell, couldn't believe that I was here, that I had couldn't even get a suicide attempt right. I felt like even more of a failure. And so the last 5 years have been about getting better and telling the truth and healing and, man, finding out what an incredible wife I have. She's the most gracious human being that I have ever known. And, yeah, so that's the last 5 years.
Wow, that's an amazing story. I mean, what strikes me, there's a couple of things that come out of your story that hit me as... The one is the trauma of when you were a child being abused one time, but the trauma is that significant. You know, the abuse itself was one thing, but the trauma was clearly a huge factor, you know, and then the theology that comes out of that, like you said, taking that magic Jesus pill. I'm sure your mother, obviously she meant well, she was doing the best that she could at the time.
Most people do. Yep.
And she honestly thought that, well, they made two decisions, didn't they? One was to kind of sweep it under the rug and figure that, as you say, as a three-year-old, you're not going to remember. And then two, when you have these flashbacks in high school, that simply praying a prayer will solve the problem and you're fine now, I guess. And so do you see that kind of thinking even now? I mean, we know a lot more about mental health today than we did back then, and that wasn't that many years ago. Do you still come across that kind of thinking in the church?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Working with places like the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and National Association for Mental Illness, we have a walk that we do every year, the Out of the Darkness Walk, that takes place in cities all around the country. And I was talking to a lady yesterday. There's an enormous, very well-known church founded here in Alabama, one of the largest churches in the country. And they have been approached to come and just send church people to come and be there, to be present at these walks if anybody wants to talk or counsel or wants prayer. And the response has been, oh, we don't have that problem in our church.
Yes, of course.
And
we
I'm
don't.
Going, you're not only an enormous home church, but you have all these church plants, 8,000 members, and you don't have a problem with mental health in your church? Are you kidding me? 44,000 people a year die by suicide, and you don't have a problem?
Exactly. The statistics can't possibly bear that out, can they? There's no way.
No.
You know,
because when you look at just the state of Alabama, one person dies by suicide every 12 hours.
Exactly. And that's just in the state of Alabama. Yeah, because my wife, when we lived in the States, she used to do post-abortion counseling. That was her ministry. And she'd hear the same types of messages from sometimes massive mega churches. You know, we don't have anybody here who's post-abortive. And she would just say, that's statistically impossible. Because I know the numbers, and one in four women, you know, so there has to be somebody here. And with 4,000 or 5,000 people sitting here, I guarantee you, there are people here, men and women, who are post-abortive. So don't tell me that, you know. So these are post-abortion is a huge mental health issue. I mean, that's a whole nother piece for sure. I mean,
I hear from people often, and it's the same thing with pornography addiction. The church is just so good at sticking their head in the sand. You look at statistics, these statistics are 4 or 5 years old, but 4 or 5 years ago, 66% of church-going men are addicted to pornography. Mm. Two-thirds of your church, but you go and say, hey, let's have a porn Sunday. Let's talk about sexual addiction. And a pastor says, we don't have that problem here.
Yeah, I remember when I was a Bible college student, we used to go to these pastors' conferences over on the Oregon coast, and it was just nothing but, 70, 80 pastors coming together for a weekend and all this, and inevitably at some point in the weekend, somebody would start confessing that they were addicted to pornography, and then, there was this huge line of people coming up to the front. But what struck me always was that, because I struggled with it too, when I got addicted to pornography when I was probably 9 or 10. You know, the typical story, you find it in the woods and then someone's thrown it away and that's it, and it's a massive issue. But I remember these guys coming up and they would just pray for them that they'd be delivered, and they expect that to work. And I'm thinking, God could deliver you from your pornography addiction. I guess it's possible, but it ain't that easy. In my view, it takes a lot of hard work. There's a lot of issues that contribute to that, and it's not the same for everybody. But it's clearly a huge issue within the church. And then you're not talking about pastors who are addicted to pornography as well. I mean, that's another deal there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge deal. That was my experience too. I was somewhere between the age of 12 and 14, went to the youth pastor and said, hey man, I've really got a problem with this thing. And he laid hands on me and prayed for me, and that was it. There was no, hey, let's set you up with an accountability partner. Let's talk about this thing. Let me give you some nothing. And that's sadly what the church does in most cases, in most scenarios. Now, we'll have whatever you have, the Celebrate Recovery, the Christian Alcoholics Anonymous, we got that going, but that's about it.
Yeah, it's true,
so
isn't it?
It's heartbreaking. We really miss it.
Yeah, we're missing out. I was thinking about that because we have some of our pet sins that we talk about in the church, don't we? At least in North America, the homosexuality, abortion, those are the two big ones, But yet things like gluttony. Nobody talks about that. Nobody talks about pornography addictions. Nobody talks about, my wife, her experience post-abortion, and yet these are massive things because a lot of times, isn't it true, people, these are compulsive addictions that they're self-medicating, aren't they? A lot of times, that was way it was for me. I feel bad about a lot of things in my life that I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm going to reach for the pornography or whatever, the bottle, whatever that compulsive addiction is. And that's basically self-medicating, isn't it? that's a lot of it, I think, behind a lot of these compulsive addictions. I mean, it doesn't. It controls
one
you.
Of those things, yeah, it does. Yeah, and that's the. I think that's when you know it's an addiction. When you don't know. When you no longer have control over it, but it is controlling you. When it's impacting your daily life. When you're. I didn't think we were going to talk about pornography addiction today, but apparently we are. But when it. You know, when it's keeping you from your wife, your kids, your other obligations because you're so addicted to this thing, man, it's a problem. But we don't talk about this stuff in church because we've become so sanitized from real mess, from real issues, and this stuff doesn't sell. Fear, shame, and guilt keeps your pews filled and keeps people coming back and putting money in the plate. But that's it. So if it's not fear, shame, and guilt, we're probably not going to talk about it. We're certainly not going to talk about racism. We're certainly not going to talk about Charlottesville.
No, I was going to say, by the time this episode comes out, that'll have been a couple of weeks ago. But, when we're recording this now, it's just happened a matter of days ago. You know, and this is a huge issue that the country is literally, as I see it from Great Britain, is literally tearing itself apart. This is a huge problem. Because, of course, that 81% of white evangelical Christians who voted for and continue to support Donald Trump, my question is, where's the church going to be after his presidency is over? You know, I can understand they thought that he would guarantee their religious, you know, liberties and freedoms and things more so than Hillary Clinton, apparently. So there's this huge overwhelming majority of evangelicals who voted for Trump. I mean, what's your take on it being in the Deep South? You're in Birmingham. We say Birmingham here, you know, but there is a Birmingham, England. You guys stole the name, and then everyone gets ripped to shreds for mispronouncing it.
We call it the Ham here. I'm in the Ham.
The Ham, yeah. My sister actually lives in Birmingham too. So yeah.
Oh, okay.
But
cool.
What's it like on the ground there? Like you said, you're in the buckle of the Bible Belt. You know, what's been the reaction from you know, friends, churches, media, where you're at?
Well, I'll tell it to you like this. I have very few real life, flesh and blood neighbors that I'm friends with on social media anymore. And I'm friends with none of my family except my wife on social media because, I'm one of these flaming liberals. Who believes that there's room at God's table for everyone just as they are. And I cannot divorce my faith from my politics or vice versa. So I did that for a long time. I did it for a very long time. I did not become just extremely vocal until this election. But, you start listening to the actual words that come out of the president's mouth and really listening to what he's saying, and it's crazy. And that the church would so be married to this guy and just be so behind him, and this is our guy. When your religious freedoms are someone else's religious oppression, that's not freedom. It's... tweeted about it the other day that if the good news leaves one person out, it's not good news anymore.
Yeah.
So I don't know what has happened. I think we're all scared. I think fear is running the world today. Yeah. And we're afraid of anyone who doesn't look like us, dress like us, think like us, talk like us, vote like us. If you're not just like me, I'm scared that you might be trying to take my power. I'm scared that you might be trying to take my jobs. I'm scared that you might be trying to take my wife. I don't know. But it is heartbreaking that fear runs the world today. Fear and I think the power of money.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, over here in Great Britain, of course, we had the Brexit vote not that long ago. And a lot of the people were motivated by fear, the ones who voted to leave the EU, because they stoked the fear of immigrants. You know, people were saying, well, Turkey's going to be joining the EU soon. So therefore, we're going to be flooded with, you know, hundreds of thousands of Turks. They're going to be coming in, stealing your jobs, stealing your livelihood, and all the fear mongering, as you say. And the irony was, the day after Brexit was passed, Google search was, there was a huge spike on the search terms, "What is Brexit?" from the UK. People didn't even, they didn't even know what they were voting for. All they knew is, we got to block these immigrants. You know, so yes, I'm voting to leave the EU, and it was unbelievable. There was this huge spike in. They didn't even know really what. A lot of people didn't know what they were voting for, but yeah, fear runs the world. Fear and money. It seems like it's unbelievable.
Yeah,
but you're sitting in the middle of the South. You're in the Bible Belt. You know,
the Bible Belt. Yeah. It's one of those places where most people are so heavenly-minded that they're of no earthly good.
Yeah.
And it's really sad that, you know, our friends on the Holy Heretics podcast were talking on a recent episode that most of us are thankful for the death of Jesus because it gets us out of hell. But what about the life of Jesus? And what about living like that and learning from Jesus how to be the best human that you can be? And I think when we become the best human that we can be, we automatically become the best Christian that we can be. But when we separate our spirit life, our Sunday, from our Monday through Friday, we got a problem.
Yeah, how did it get to be the way it is now? I mean, it's unbelievable, this theology, and like you say, the Holy Heretics have touched on this in other podcasts too. You know, you get your golden ticket to heaven, and then you're in the club, but then, what then? What do you do with the rest of your life? Because you're clutching that golden ticket that gets you into heaven, then why are Christians so completely divorced from the environment and issues like racism and poverty and injustice and on and on? And that's historic. I mean, it's among the conservative fundamentalists, you know. But of course, they were fighting against the liberals, so they can't be seen to be identified with liberal theology, you know. But it's had a big backlash now, hasn't it? 50, 60, 70 years later, we're still in that tradition, at least as far as the conservative side. I mean, are you in the middle of conservatism in the South?
Oh, yeah, big time. Yeah, I mean, we're as red of a state as you can get.
Yeah.
And, you know, Baptist or Methodist church on every corner. And, it's here, it's Jesus, the military, and Alabama football. That's it. And probably Alabama football at the top. We really should probably flip that. It's probably Alabama football, then Jesus, then the military.
Yeah. College football,
and all that,
massive, isn't it?
Well and good, but we're so out of what we've made idols out of this stuff, and we're forgetting to love our neighbor. We're forgetting that, okay, so we've been given this great freedom. If we're Christians and we believe in what Jesus did on the cross for us and we cling to that kind of stuff, then let's start there and let's live this free life that we've been given to go and liberate other people. I talked to a guy on my show just today, and we were talking about racism. We did a show on Charlottesville, and he said, "I believe that love your neighbor has something to do with racism. I believe in the God who went and freed the Egyptian slaves. That's the God I believe in. But this other God who separates people and is misogynistic and is, you know, and all of these we separate everything out, that's not my God."
Yeah.
So I think the church is complaining a lot about millennials like me leaving the church and wondering what to do and how to get them back. And they think let's make a better light show. Let's add a subwoofer under the stage. Let's put a coffee shop in the foyer and a bookstore and roll out the red carpet and put, you know, some hipster worship leader on stage with skinny jeans. We don't give a damn about that. We want to talk about the issues that are affecting our lives and our friends' lives. And we want to come to church, and our friends come to church with us too. But if they're not welcome because of the color of their skin or the lifestyle they live or the way they were born, then we don't want to be there either. And I think that's the message that church leaders aren't wanting to hear or are missing today.
Yeah. Do you think it tends to be a particularly American Christian thing that it's I mean, the rest of the world looks at America, they can't divorce religion and politics, as you said. And that seems to be a uniquely American thing, you know, where it's funny because over here in Great Britain, of course, historically, there's no separation of church and state. You know, the Anglican Church, and before that it was the Catholic Church. Even now, the Anglican Church is the official state church of the country, of England anyway. The Queen is the head of the church. And so there is a church and state, there's a constitutional connection. Whereas in America, of course, there's a constitutional separation, but yet you see so many Christians involved in the political sphere. Whereas you don't see that, certainly here in Great Britain, you know, and it seems to be, people can't seem to get their heads around that over here. But you're right in the middle of all that, aren't you? You know, separate politics and religion. And yet, technically, there is a constitutional separation of church and state. But it doesn't seem to go the way, it goes the way of the church interfering in the state, but not the church, no, the church interfering in the state, but not the other way around.
Right. That's exactly right. And it, to me, it again goes back to fear and power. If the religious right here thinks, okay, I'll support Donald Trump and I'll have his ear, you know, Franklin Graham and, you know, all of these, I'll tickle his ear and he'll, you know, I'll scratch his back, he'll scratch mine kind of thing. And the religious right, my gosh, they've got some votes. They got a whole lot of votes. Yeah. And so if he says just enough to sort of make them think that, well, just maybe, you know, sure, you can lay hands on me and pray for me. Sure you can. Yeah, what's that going to hurt?
Having Bible studies in the White House.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. That's the newest thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, this guy's been doing it for a long time, apparently, in Congress and Senate. But now it's the new thing, isn't it? It's Bible studies in the White House. And my British friends just, they can't get their heads around that in any way, shape, or form. I mean, if you said, we're going to have a Bible study at Parliament in London, it would never happen. Yeah. And yet, here's the weird thing. In high schools and, well, what they call secondary schools, like elementary schools, they teach religious education. That's part of the curriculum. So you cover Christianity, Islam, Buddhism. That's part of the state curriculum in this country. Is RE, you know, whereas in the States, of course, you can't teach, well, any religion, you know, in public schools, but it's just a common part of the curriculum here, and nobody seems to have a problem with it, because every religion supposedly equally presented, you know, it's not just Christianity, it's all the religions, and kids can learn about Buddhism and Islam and Sikhism and Christianity as part of their, you know, well-rounded curriculum, science and math and everything else, and religion. It's amazing.
Wow. You know? It is amazing. Yeah, the American church, for sure, I don't know about other places, but for sure, we've become so disconnected from culture, we've become so disconnected from science, and we expect people to check their brains at the door, you know.
Yeah.
You go sit in a Sunday school class or a Sunday morning service sometime here, and you listen to what they're talking about, knowing, you know, that things like Charlottesville and other things are going on, and you sit and listen to it, and it's just so completely disconnected from real life. It's just this Christian fluff, and we sing these fluffy songs, and it's so exhausting, this man-made construct, this Christian machine that we have here is, oh man, it's so exhausting.
Yeah, well, that's why when we finally walked away from the church here, because my wife talked about this in one of our podcasts, she said what finally did it for her was we were in a service and the preacher made the statement, he was talking about depression, going back to this issue of mental health. He said, you know, now if you're a Christian and you feel like you're depressed and you're not full of joy, he said, you might want to consider asking whether or not you're even a Christian. And she just sat there, she was digging her hand into my knee, you know, and my knee was cracking, I think. And she was coming out of, you know, a post-abortion counseling, being post-abortive herself, dealing with depression, dealing with mental health, to hear a black and white statement like that, knowing that what that kind of theology can do to people who are genuinely struggling with mental health, is unbelievable. I mean, what can you say to something like that?
I can say that the church could learn a lot from a psych ward.
Yeah.
So I write about it in my book that when I rolled down that hallway in a wheelchair by this orderly, and the door, that big giant metal door, brown door, slammed shut behind me, and I was locked in, I was institutionalized, I was scared to death. And we're going through the motions, we're going and doing arts and crafts, and we're taking a nap, and we're eating three meals a day, and we're talking about our feelings, or are you happy, sad, mad, or glad? And it felt so pointless. But about 3.5 or 4 years after the fact, I realized that it was all about social support. It was all about emotional support. It was all about us coming together, sharing our stories, being brutally honest, respecting each other, and getting better. And if the church looked more like that, if we could truly come just as we are and share our stories and embrace our shared humanity and break bread together and let people come and rest their weary souls, our churches would be packed every Sunday. They'd be standing in line in the parking lot trying to get in.
Yeah.
If that's what church looked like today, rather than this performance thing that we've got going on, this great big show that we do on Sunday mornings to entertain people, people want to find help for their anxiety, not even necessarily healing. I'm not expecting to come to a Benny Hinn crusade and fall out and be healed. I'm not even looking for that. But I do believe in a God who works ordinarily through social support, through medication, through therapy and counseling and all these. This God that I have found, my experience is that God sits with us in the ashes, that God is an ever-present help in times of trouble. That is true for me, but I haven't met a God who snaps his fingers and everything is magically better. I haven't met this God of the sanitized sanctuary where everything is pristine and clean and pretty. That's not real life for me. And so I think if we would get back to that, to the message of Jesus, that you really can come just as you are, that Jesus was really serious when he said, love your neighbor. That was a big deal. He wasn't just kidding there. Our generation, I know for me as a millennial, we're so determined to remove stigma, to squash these labels that we've put on people, and just to see the human being in front of us. And if the church did that, man, oh my gosh, we either have to completely walk away, or we've got to be really patient and really stubborn in this necessity that we redefine the church. We've either got to redefine it or just burn the house down. I mean, like it's one or the other for me, but this status quo thing that we've been doing the last however many hundred years, it's not working.
Not working. Yeah, it's true, isn't it? I remember something you said. Reminded me of what Frank Viola talks about in Reimagining Church, doesn't he? He says that the problem with these entertainment or auditorium churches that you're describing is that it actually keeps people in a state of spiritual infancy because they're not being allowed to utilize their gifts and their passions. They're not growing. Everything's being done for them. All they have to do is sit and soak it all in. But, you know, I always tell my students, imagine a group of babies sitting there in diapers, and that's basically what's going on in a lot of these churches. You are actually keeping people in a state of spiritual infancy. And one of the things that I was thinking of, too, when you talked about being real, you know, my wife, when she used to lead her post-abortion counseling groups, these women would say, isn't this what church is supposed to be, what you just described? this was the first time in pretty much all of their lives that they had actually really opened up and being honest and told their stories. Because for most of these women and men as well, it was a dirty, dark, horrible secret that nobody could ever know about, you know. And they burying that secret was it would manifest itself in a lot of other areas of their lives in unhealthy ways, physically and emotionally. And for the first time, they actually were open, honest, vulnerable in a place of safety and trust and transparency. And they were utterly transformed. And they said, wow, I thought that's what church was supposed to be. And then they would go back to their home churches and they were just like, what is going on here? This has no relationship to what I've been experiencing. That's real transformation. You know, that's real healing. Why can't we do that in the church?
That's right. I was in a suicide prevention training yesterday. Had nothing to do with church or faith at all. It was just a room full of random people who are passionate about suicide prevention. And as it always happens, toward the end of the time together, it was about a three-hour class, people started opening up and sharing their stories and why they were there and their experiences and the person they'd lost or their own lived experience and crying, and there were people hugging, and it was just the most beautiful picture, looking around the room at 16 to 20 people being honest, being real. And that's what we're hungry for. We're hungry for honesty. We're hungry for conversation, where we want to be able to show up at church with our success and our failure, with our vulnerability and our doubts and our questions and whatever's left of this deconstructed faith that so many of us have. And we're not looking for an expert. Like, I'm not looking for a PhD to stand up there and tell me what I should believe. I want somebody to maybe sort of guide a conversation, but we want dialogue. We've got people that are dying in the pew next to us because of all sorts of things that have happened, bad choices that they've made and horrible choices that other people have made and done things to them. But the church is arguing about the color of the carpet.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's just heartbreaking. The only way it's going to change is if we're willing to say, okay, it's time to throw out the water. Keep the baby, but throw out the bathwater, you know, and because there's a lot of bathwater.
Yeah, as I think it was Scott Watkins on The Holy Heretics, he said, the problem with throwing out the bathwater is that the baby grows up and then starts asking questions later on. And we don't have answers for those questions, you know. We've thrown the water out, but the baby's starting to ask the tough questions, and we've run out of pat answers, you know, to give them. It's unbelievable. But now, I mean, I wanted to touch on something you said about education, because you know, I came through the system. I went to Bible college. I went to seminary. I did the whole thing. You know, I wanted to be a pastor and a minister and all the rest of it. And the problem is, we're creating a clergy class, and we have been for a long time. And you have to change that system as well, because what are we producing in Bible colleges? What are we producing in seminaries? We're sending these men and women out to churches to be leaders, and they're just promulgating the problem that's already there. This educated elite, like you said, they know Greek, they know Hebrew. You can't understand the Bible without my help. I have to explain it for you, and I'll even apply it for you. You know, you don't have to do anything. All you have to do is go do what I tell you, and that's basically the system that we've created. That's a typical sermon, you know. Is I explain the text, I tell you what it means, and I'll even apply it for you. I'll do all the work. Yeah. And this is going back to Frank Viola's point that why do you need to do anything if you've got the guy thinking for you as well? They're doing all the heavy lifting.
That's right.
All you have to do is the go and do part. You know? And so we've got this system that if you change it, man, you got to change the whole thing.
Yeah,
and that's a tall
order. It's almost
order.
One of those. Let's just start over. Let's just bulldoze it and start over.
Yeah, that's where I'm at.
And it's I am too. And And, you talk about mental health. Maybe we talk about mental wellness that people can understand. So maybe there's people listening that aren't depressed or bipolar. Maybe they don't have anxiety. Maybe they've never considered suicide, but maybe they're just stressed out. And most of us are chronically stressed out.
Yeah.
The best way to drop your stress level immediately, get honest with somebody. Find a support system. Build a safe community. If you can't find it in the church, build your own community. Have a dinner club. Have people over once a month and sit around and break bread and talk about your doubts and your struggles and get honest with people. You do that and your stress level will drop. I mean, exponentially. It's amazing what confessing our mess does to our stress and our shame. That's the stuff I'm passionate about. And I think that's what the church is going to have to look like for a while. It's going to take people like us pulling away and saying, I can't be a part of this machine. I can't be a part of this thing that is hurting more than it's helping. So I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to be, for me, faithful to the Bible. I'm going to hold on to the message of Jesus, but I'm gonna just invite my friends to have these hard conversations that the church is not willing to have with me.
Yeah, and that's why I love meeting people like you, Steve, is because what I sense in your voice is that same passion that I have. You know, it's funny because when I came out of, I was a pastor of a church for 10 years. I was an elder and a pastor. That church, we had to close it down. It was very messy, very ugly. I got blamed for everything. And I walked away. I didn't want to have anything to do with church or Christians ever again. But over the years, I've actually rediscovered, I'm very passionate about the concept of the church. I still believe in the church, you know, and I think I hear that in your voice as well. I believe in the church.
Oh,
I really do. People think, all you do is rip the church to pieces. No, I'm critical of it, but I still believe in it, what it could be.
Absolutely.
But sadly, like you say, it's this machine, it's the system, we have to prop it up, we're beholden to it, and all these things. And how in the world can we change it from within? It's very, very difficult. Sometimes you're better off, as you say, bulldozing it and starting completely from scratch.
That's right. Oh, yeah, that's me all day long. I'm not a church hater. If you go to church and you get something out of it, okay. But for me, I don't. It's not feeding me anymore. It's harming me.
Yeah.
My friend Kevin Garcia says bad theology kills. And he's right. Bad theology is killing people.
Yeah.
And then on the other end of that, I have a dear friend who is a pastor, a phenomenal blogger, Jeremy Sims. And he says the Church of Jesus Christ is the hope of the world. Now, we have two very different perspectives on what that means. But I agree with him from my perspective. The church is the hope of the world. If we're doing church and living like Jesus, yeah, for sure. If we're saying come just as you are, if we're loving our neighbor, whatever that looks like, with no strings attached, yes, that is the hope of the world. Love is the hope of the world.
Yeah, I can get behind that. If that's you want to call that church, then happy days. I'm all for it, man.
Yep.
I mean, it's just such a threat, isn't it, to so many people who are vested in the system. Their livelihoods, their whole, everything's at stake. There's too much at stake. You know, they can't criticize it. And this is, again, something that the Holy Heretics have talked about as well, isn't it? That as a church leader, a pastor or whatever, you can't voice your fears, your doubts, your concerns, your theological problems, because you have to have all the answers. You're supposed to be seen as the expert. You went to Bible college, you went to seminary, you've got those degrees hanging on your wall. You know, how could you possibly have doubts and fears and concerns? That's not possible. We don't want to hear that.
That's what ended the last church I was at. I've actually only been out of a paid position in the church for less than a year. And that's what happened. We were at an event, a very small gathering at a friend's house with Ed Bacon, who wrote 8 Habits of Love, which is an amazing book. It's all about moving from the house of fear into the house of love. And Ed's a retired Episcopal priest and just a brilliant spiritual leader. But I asked a very difficult question, a major doubt that I've had for a long time. And our pastor was listening, was watching on FaceTime and listening, and heard me, the worship pastor, ask my great big question. And boy, that was it. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. So
you're officially a troublemaker.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I've been a troublemaker for a while, but that one, boy, that did it.
Yeah. Well, a similar thing happened to me over here. I wasn't in leadership, but I was an ex-pastor, and we'd had a small home group and things, and I wrote some critical things on a blog that I was doing at the time, and it turned out that some of the leaders found out about some of the things I'd said, and I actually wasn't critical of that church specifically, but they thought I was being critical, and so they basically blackballed me, and I was wondering why they never let me preach or do anything like that. And I found out a couple years later, they read this stuff that you wrote. And nobody ever came to talk to me about it and said, hey, you know, what's going on, man? Because I was raw. I just come out of this terrible situation, you know, of closing a church and being blamed and everything for it. Yeah, I was raw, you know, but nobody took that into account. They just said, well, this guy's a troublemaker. We need to, you know, blackball him and, you know, shut the door on him. And I didn't even find out till several years later. You know, so.
Yeah. Oh, that was me. I was told, hey, man, you can be a worship pastor and you can have doubts and questions, but you can't be a worship pastor and publicly have doubts and questions.
Yes.
So that was clear as it could be. And I said, well, you know what? I can't separate my humanity from my pastoral role. I am a real live whole person here, and I'm wrestling with some major matters of faith right now, but I'm wrestling with them, and I think that's so good and so healthy and authentic and genuine and all the, you know, all those words you want to put on it. And so I can't stop. Like, I've been bitten by the bug, and so I have to wrestle.
Yeah, well, I'm encouraged that we've had this conversation. I mean, I know we should probably wrap it up. We've been talking for nearly an hour now. This has been amazing. I've absolutely loved it. I mean, I would love to keep in touch with you some more for sure. I mean, there's got to be a reason why people like you and I have this passion for the next whatever's coming down the road. There's got to be. This cannot be an accident, in my view, you know, that I met you through Holy Heretics and, you know, now we're talking on Skype. And you're on the other side of the world. No, I'm on the other side of the world.
That's right. You are, not me.
Yeah. You're home. You're in America, and I'm here in Great Britain. But thank you, Steve Austin. This has been absolutely fantastic. I've loved every minute of this conversation. I wish we could keep talking, but I know you have stuff you need to do. The day's almost over for me here, but you're just getting started over there.
I got to go pick up kids and go to Walmart. So, welcome to America.
That's an American thing. All right. Thank you very much, Steve, for being on my podcast. I'm sure we will stay in touch and maybe we can do this again.
That sounds great. Thanks so much.
Well, I thank you for listening in to this episode of Mind Shift here on the Preacher's Forum podcast. What a fantastic conversation with Steve Austin. You know, I think the thing I love the most about the conversation with Steve is, as I said at the beginning of this episode, his words were, I'm an open book. And that absolutely came across. And you can hear the honesty and the openness in Steve's voice. His life is an open book. And yet he says, this is what the church needs to become. This is the aim that we're striving for: openness, honesty, transparency, vulnerability. How else can we expect anyone to grow spiritually, to mature, if we're not going to be open and honest and talk about our faults, our struggles, even to the point, as Steve talked about, wanting to commit suicide and very nearly succeeding in ending his life. And yet, we believe that for some reason he has been spared, and if nothing else, it's to inspire other people, to help other people, and to give other people hope, help, and healing, and restoration in this whole area of mental health in the church. And you can hear as well his passion for the church that comes across in the conversation as well. All right, now as we wrap up this show, as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, I wanted to talk about how you can get a hold of both myself and Steve Austin. We'd love to hear your comments and feedback on this episode. You can find Steve on Twitter at IamSteveAustin. And all you have to do is kind of remember that tagline, because he has a website as well, IamSteveAustin.net. And you'll find a lot more resources, life coaching and blog articles and things he's written. He wrote a fantastic book called From Pastor to a Psych Ward, talking about his experiences. And so it's great to see him being open and honest and vulnerable and helping other people who are struggling. You can also get a hold of me. I would love to hear your thoughts and feedback on this episode as well, or any of the other podcasts that I've done. You can follow me on Twitter at Preachers Forum. You can also find me on Instagram at the same name, at Preachers Forum. You can send me an email and I will respond to you, preachersforum@gmail.com. You can also stop by and like my Facebook page, facebook.com/thepreachersforum. You can also have a look at my website, preachersforum.com, where there are a lot of resources on a wide variety of subjects that may prove helpful to you as well. And one last item of housekeeping. If you have found the content on my website or this podcast helpful to you, please consider supporting the work of the Preachers Forum on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/preachersforum and join the others who are part of supporting my efforts to get this stuff out there. So for as little as $1 a month, you can support my work. This gives you access to a closed Facebook group, the Preachers Forum podcast group on Facebook, where we have a great supportive community, and you can be a part of that for, as I say, as little as $1 a month. I'll just mention one last item before I let you go, and that is next Friday's episode features the first half of a talk that Gary Hayes and I had on the subject of leaving the church to find God. So that's going to be an absolutely amazing episode. It's going to be two parts, so look for that next Friday. And thank you for joining me. Once again, I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. This has been another episode of my Mind Shift series right here on the Preachers Forum podcast.